welcome to Let It Roll, the insanely ambitious musical history podcast hosted by Nate Wilcox. We've covered the early history of rock and roll, country music in the 20th century, the rise of hip-hop, disco, and electronic dance music, and heavy metal. Stay tuned for our histories of Broadway, opera, punk rock, jazz, blues, ragtime, Latin music, and gospel. Follow the Let It Roll podcast on Twitter, at Let It Rollcast, and check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to more great podcasts at www.pantheonpodcasts.com. We've already raised enough to pay for 11 months worth of episodes of this show. We're going to keep the fundraising drive going until we've got a full year covered. We're almost there. Please give if you can afford to. Today, Nate welcomes Ken Emerson to discuss his book, Always Magic in the Air, The Bomp and Brilliance of the Brill Building Era. Email us at letitrollpodcast@gmail.com. Pop in those earbuds and enjoy.
It's time to Let It Roll. I'm your host, Nate Wilcox, and today we're welcoming Ken Emerson, the author of Always Magic in the Air, The Bomp and Brilliance of the Brill Building Era. I hope my microphone popper was working for that to cut all those bumps out. Hey, Ken, welcome to the show.
Oh, good to be talking to you.
Cool. So tell us about just the big picture introduction of the Brill Building Era, because it's not even one building, actually. This stuff actually happened in what, three or four buildings? And what is it about the Brill? When was it? And
well, it was the Brill Building had been a fixture since really the 50s, and even it goes back almost to the Depression as a building where popular songwriters and publishers and little recording studios had been headquartered. And it had a name, the Brill Building, because it was built by the Brill brothers. And however, there were other buildings nearby, just one a couple of blocks up the street on the other side of where many songwriters were. But the Brill Building sort of lent its, but that name, that building had only a number, not a name. So the Brill Building became shorthand. I had trouble with the actually talking about it and figuring out how to do this as the title of the book. Because you say the Brill Building era, but it was obviously not, everything was not in the Brill Building. I was particularly interested in this period of music because the combination of musical influences was profound and I think shaped a lot of our music today. And I had before that, I had written a biography of Stephen Foster and his musical times, which was the middle of the 19th century. And the name of that book was Doodah, Stephen Foster and the Rise of Popular Music. And I had written that book because I was always interested in the many, many years that I've been writing about rock and roll. And when did it first become popular for white teenagers to pretend they were black? And obviously, that's a force behind rock and roll from the very beginning and still is today, or much of popular music. And it stretched back to blackface minstrel music, the kind that is now very awkward in terms of how we can talk about it, because it's... obviously, it is deeply racist, but American history and American music are deeply racist, too. And I think it's always better to confront that than to sweep it under the rug, so to speak, and politely ignore it. But when I was thinking, so my initial impulse, even though it was something about the 19th century, was to write the initial impulse was my interest in 20th century popular music. And what interested me in this era was that I did not want to write another book that was really dramatically contrasting and comparing black culture and white culture. And I realized that one of the most important elements of the so-called Brill Building sound was Latin music. And that much of this came out of New York. at the peak of Puerto Rican migration, and that the most interesting music of this time was a combination of Black music, Latin music, and white music. And so that was the hook, essentially, that led me to become interested in this subject, and I still am 20 years later.
Awesome, and I'm so grateful for you to come and talk about a book that you wrote this long ago. Some people don't want to do that. But yeah, the Brill Building era, for people who don't know, this is sometimes called the Dark Ages of rock and roll, because Elvis was in the army, Chuck Berry was in jail, Jerry Lee Lewis was disgraced, Little Richard had turned Christian, Buddy Holly and Richie Valens had died in a car crash, Eddie Cochran had been killed in a car crash, Gene Vincent was mangled in that same car crash. So it seemed to some people, like John Lennon maybe, that all the great heroes of rock and roll were taken out and replaced by Fabian and Frankie Avalon and Bobby Darin and Bobby V and so on and so on. But when you, at the same time, somebody like John Lennon would say, but I loved Phil Spector. I loved Motown.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
He idolized McCartney and Lennon idolized Jerry Goffin and Carole King, and that initially that's who they wanted to be. And also, when you think about the music of whether it be the Drifters and Save the Last Dance for Me or Sweets for My Sweet or This Magic Moment, or you think of the Coasters and Yakety Yak, Don't Talk Back, and who's Charlie Brown and Fee Fi Fo Fum, I Smell Smoke in the Auditorium, or Dion and the Belmonts, or Dion himself singing The Wanderer. I think it was every generation thinks that the past generation they're superior to. But I think that the idea that popular music was barren before the Beatles is absurd. Among other things, when the Rolling Stones and the Beatles began, most of their material were songs that were performed largely by Black, but by white Americans too, only a year or two beforehand. I mean, think of Twist and Shout. I mean, one of the greatest songs that the Beatles performed in their early career. I mean, that was not something that came from a previous era. It was almost a contemporary song, and only a year old.
Yes, and we've talked about Burt Burns. He's not in this book, but we've done a whole episode on Burt Burns. But yeah, the great Burt Burns, who wrote Twist and Shout, who produced so many great album records for Solomon Burke and stuff. But let's start actually with kind of where this starts, and there's no two ways about it. Lieber and Stoller, Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller, were the first independent production songwriting team in rock and roll, starting in the early 50s with Big Mama Thornton and Hound Dog, working with the great Johnny Otis and the evil Duke of Houston, Don Roby, the business guy who didn't pay him any royalties. But Lieber and Stoller start out in L.A. Stoller, I might be wrong on this, one of them's from Baltimore. The other one grew up in L.A., but they both ended up in L.A. as young teenagers and came together. And there were two Jewish kids who loved the blues and who could write it convincingly enough to get Big Mama Thornton to record their songs. That is no joke. And what you're talking about, yes, in the course of this, five, 6 year Let It Roll project, exactly what we see in the Brill Building is this cultural coming together where people like Lieber and Stoller and Goffin and King and Sadaka and Greenfield, Doc Pomus and Mort Schumann, Barry and Greenwich, were Jeff Berry and Ellie Greenwich, were very aware of not only rock and roll and blues, but they were also people who had been raised on what we call the Great American Songbook. And so people like Irving Berlin and Cole Porter and the Gershwins, these were songs somebody like Phil Spector could sit down at a piano and sing all night. So these people were bringing in that American tradition as well, which was a heavily Jewish tradition. And a lot of these people, maybe almost all of them are Jewish. Not all of them. Doc Pomus. A lot of Jewish people doing this. And like you said, they're combining the R&B and blues that they love so much, and the singers of these songs are often Black. And there were also Black songwriters. Otis Blackwell, who wrote, you know, Great Balls of Fire and All Shook Up and so many of the great rock and roll songs. He was in the Brill Building, too. He's the guy who brought Doc Pomus in there. And just I'll close the thing about John Lennon with this. When John Lennon met Doc Pomus's daughter in a convenience store in a bodega in Manhattan in the mid 70s, she shyly introduced, you know, there's a whole crowd of people all in the store going, is that John Lennon? Is that the Beatle? And she just got up her nerve and said, excuse me, Mr. Lennon, my dad is Doc Pomus. And he turned and looked at her and he gave her this intense stare. And she didn't know if he was mad or what. And then he started singing Save the Last Dance for Me and sang the entire the crowd assembled around him. And that tells you what these people meant to the next generation. So let's get back to Lieber and Stoller. Steph's telling me I got to cue a song. And let's hear Stand By Me by a young Benny King who has just gone solo from the Drifters. And this is a collaboration with Lieber and Stoller who are in the booth producing.
And the land is dark, and the moon is the only light we'll see. No, I won't be afraid. Oh, I won't be afraid. Just as long as you stand by me. So dark.
And that was the great Benny King, who, of course, sang the vocals on the song I was just talking about, John Lennon singing Save the Last Dance for Me. But we just did a Doc Pomus episode, so I don't want to play that one again. But Stand By Me is pretty much just as good. Benny King was the singer. But so Lieber and Stoller, tell us about how they went from L.A., got their start in L.A., and how they came to New York and what happened once they got to New York.
Well, they were very popular in Los Angeles, writing songs for a variety of artists, almost all of whom, with a couple of exceptions, were Black. And they were all on the rhythm and blues and the race charts. Not very few of them were really that popular with white audiences at that point. But they began to have success with the original group of the Drifters that had no relationship to the group that recorded Stand By Me and other songs. They also had success with a group called the Robins, who would later become the Coasters. And so they began to attract the attention of producers and record companies in the East Coast, where most of the national record companies were still located at that time, and particularly in Atlantic Records, for whom the Drifters recorded. And they were invited to come east on the basis of their success, largely with the Robins Coasters, as they were called. And by the way, that's one of the reasons why they were called. They changed their name from the Robins to the Coasters because they were East Coast company and a West Coast group. And the Drifters, to try to recreate their success with a new group of Drifters because their manager had fired all the old ones, to take their music further. So they worked with the Ertegun brothers and Jerry Wexler, who were the principals of Atlantic, working with those two groups. And the two groups were very different. The Coasters were comic. Everything they did was funny. To this day, I mentioned earlier, you think about to Charlie Brown, Fee-Fi-Fo from I Smell Smoke in the Auditorium, or to my mind, one of their favorite, the double entendre of Poison Ivy and Venereal Disease. Those were funny songs, but the Drifters were sang romantic songs. And Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller were not very, well, particularly Jerry Lieber, who had a very sarcastic, comic point of view, were not very good at writing romantic ballads. So they began, when they came to New York, to cast about for writers who could write more romantic songs that were appropriate for the Drifters, and then Lieber and Stoller would produce them. And this is one of the reasons, one of the creations of the Brill Building sound, was that they got involved with Doc Pomus and Mort Schumann, and later with Barry Mann and Cynthia Weil, and with Jerry Goffin and Carole King. So they were really mentors to a generation of fabulous writers who, at the beginning, were scarcely out of their teens, and Lieber and Stoller taught them, and taught them well. Also, Burt Bacharach and Hal David. I mean, Burt Bacharach had been the director of Marlene Dietrich's band, and he realized that that if he was going to make money, he had to learn about rock and roll. So he literally came to Lieber and Stoller and said, "Teach me how to make pop records that aren't just sort of old middle of the road records." And he learned from them as well. So you said in the beginning that that this is where the story begins, and that's why Lieber and Stoller were just so important. I also want to stress, by the way, that, or point out, that there are some people that you could also include in this that are not in quite that family. I think most notably people like Bob Crewe and Bob Gaudio and the Four Seasons. So there were other principles that in this era. I chose not to write about them simply because they didn't have the personal relationship with the other group of people that I wrote about and we're talking about today. So the Brill Building sound and era extended beyond the principal songwriters that we're discussing today.
Yes, absolutely, and that's a very important point. But you just had to narrow it down. You didn't talk about Otis Blackwell or Burt Burns in the book either. But just you told a lot of story here. But there's a lot more to learn about the Brill Building. It was deep and rich, and there's a lot of talented people doing a lot of cool stuff. But Lieber and Stoller work at Atlantic for a while, and then they try to audit Atlantic. And I've told this story several times on the show with Ed Ward and others. And Jerry Wexler basically fired them for having the temerity to ask for an audit. And they found out that Atlantic owed them $18,000 they hadn't collected, but they got fired, and I don't even know if they got the money. So they had to go out and start their own record label. Now, as great as they were at being songwriters and producers, they weren't the best song pickers. And they come in touch with this guy, George Goldner, who was kind of one of the great Latin record producers and record label men of the 50s era, which preceded it. And all these kids were dancing to Latin music almost every weekend in the 50s. So this is incredibly important. And we're doing a series with Ned Sublett on where is this Latin music coming from Cuba and the Congo. It was coming up. It was literally coming from the Congo up through Cuba and Jamaica and the islands, and then coming up to New York via Puerto Rico and coming up. And these kids had listened to this stuff. So George Goldner's a big guy from Latin music. And then he had been the mastermind, or he'd worked with Frankie Lyman and the Teenagers. Why Do Fools Fall in Love? And the problem with George Goldner was he was a chronic gambling addict. So he was owned by another guy, basically, named Morris Levy, who was the Genovese family representative, shall we say, in the music business. So Lieber and Stoller partnered with George Goldner. They have a stack of demos. He says, "Let me hear what you got." And he goes through the stack and he picked out the exact songs that were hit records. And Redbird Records goes on this tear for several years of making tons of records, lots of hits. And one day, the Genovese family checks in with Lieber and Stoller, and they end up giving away their share in that for $1 each. And George Goldner bet it all on the horses, and Morris Levy ended up with it. But let's get on to Goffin and King. Tell us about Carole King and Jerry Goffin. And this is one point before you start. If you've watched Mad Men, Steph tells me I got a cue again. So let's get the cue in there. And let's go with the great classic by Goffin and King, "Will You Still Love Me Tomorrow?"
Yeah.
And that was the Shirelles singing Will You Still Love Me Tomorrow, one of the great classics written by a young Carole King and a young Jerry Goffin. And the interesting part is this is a song from a woman's point of view, but the man wrote the lyrics. Carole King wrote the music. Who are they? How'd they come together? And what did they do?
Well, first of all, just the story of that song is pretty remarkable. The first hit by the Shirelles was a song called Tonight's the Night. And so Don Kirshner's record company and song publishing company, All Don Music, wanted to write the follow-up to Tonight's the Night. And he had urged Jerry Goffin and Carole King, whom he had hired, but they had not yet written a hit. And they were recently married, and it was a shotgun wedding, because Carole had become pregnant. One night, not that long, when they had an infant daughter, Carole King went out to play Mahjong with friends, and Jerry, who was still working part-time, well, actually full-time in a chemical factory, after work went out to bowl with some buddies. He came back and he found a note on the piano from Carole King saying, "Sweetie, I mean, I've written a half of the song. What do you think?" And he figured it out, and he said, "Oh, this is absolutely fantastic." And he then wrote the lyrics. And then Carole came back, and by midnight, together they had written the bridge, and the song was finished. And the point that one of the great things about this song is it's a song about a woman's fear of becoming pregnant. Will you still love me tomorrow? And of course, Jerry did love her tomorrow, and their marriage lasted some time. They were eventually divorced, but it rang true to them as a young couple. Ironically, they recorded a demo, and Don Kirshner, the head of All Don Music, thought it was so great that he wanted Johnny Mathis to sing it. And the idea that you would have a man who, among other things, was gay, sing this "Will You Still Love Me Tomorrow" about a woman's fears of pregnancy was just absurd. But Donnie was not always, although he had a great ear often for hit records, sometimes he could be a little tuner, or shall we say, gender deaf. And then also Tony Orlando of Dawn later on. And, you know, "Not Three Times on the Window, If You Hear Me," I mean, and "Wear a Yellow Ribbon." He was a young man who was also involved with All Don Music. He wanted to sing it, but thank God it went to the Shirelles. Ironically, when the Shirelles first heard it, they thought it sounded too much like a country song, and they were not quite sure that it was right for them. But Scepter Records, their recording company, overcame their reluctance, and it was a huge hit for them. And it was so successful that Jerry Goffin was able to quit his job at the chemical company where he was working and become a full-time songwriter.
And the thing I got to mention about Spector Records before we go, we won't be talking about them much, but this is a company founded by Florence Greenberg, who had sold a previous record company. I think she co-owned with her ex-husband for $4,000 and started this label. And she met a handsome young black man named Luther Dixon. And they became surreptitious lovers and produced a great string of hits. So there's a lot of integrating and cultural mixing going on. And the other thing about the Brill Building is so many of these women, Carole King, Cynthia Weil and Ellie Greenwich, this is really the first. There were some female songwriters that made their mark in the Great American Songbook, but this really is the first time in American history that women are at the absolute forefront of popular music. These three were some of the key. They were holding their own with Burt Bacharach and Mort Shuman and Mike Stoller, and Neil Sedaka, who were all musical titans in the composition department. And these ladies were more than holding their own. So this is, the baby boomers are already much more egalitarian and much more pro-woman than previous generations without even really realizing it. They're already doing that. So we got to rush because I want to cover everybody. Let's talk next about another Aldon Publishing Group team. And this is Neil Sedaka and Norman Greenfield. How'd they get together? Who were they? And what did they do while they were with Aldon?
Well, they are really the beginning of Aldon because they were the first songwriting group, a pair that Don Kirshner became involved with. And they wrote songs for Connie Francis that were the first hits for Don Kirshner as a music publisher. So they really, Neil and Howie are really the people with whom the story of Aldon music begins. Neil was a classically trained pianist. Carole King went to the same high school. She was a couple of years behind him and idolized Neil. It actually was a very, over the years, there's been sort of a frostiness in the way they've talked about each other. I think partly because Carole King became so famous that Neil felt a little outclassed or competitive with her. And also one of his first hit songs was called Carol, Oh Carol, in tribute to her. And so they were, these people were all very close to each other.
I can interrupt you for 1 second, Ken. I want to add one point about that. Neil Sedaka, and I don't remember you talking about this in the book, but it's a known thing. Neil Sedaka has this great run of hits as a very young teen with Norman Greenfield as his lyricist. Incredibly talented composer.
Howie Greenfield.
Sorry. Thank you for correcting me there. And but Neil let his mother manage his affairs. And she and his and another man who came in to manage him had an affair and ended up squandering his entire money. So when he was resenting Carole King's massive success in the early 70s, you got to keep in mind he had already been famous and now he was not having hits anymore and he was broke. And he has this massive comeback in the 70s and got it, you know, built up a fortune again. But so we can see why Neil was a little bitter. But let's get back to what they did.
Okay. Well, I want to mention here one of my pet peeves, and that is it is outrageous and insulting and ignorant that Neil Sedaka is not a member of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Agreed.
And
it's
not
absolutely.
I mean, it is just it is criminal and an indictment of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
I'm going to call out Jan Winter on that. It's also homophobia. And it's interesting because Neil Sedaka, Let me finish. Neil Sedaka self-described as himself as a sissy. He's not gay. He's hetero. But Howie Greenfield was gay. And yeah. I believe that the Neil Sedaka presented as a sissy, as a self-described quote-unquote sissy, that homophobes like I was when I was a younger man, like so many people are, that is the reason, because his music holds up. So go ahead.
Not only does it hold up in terms of, I mean, Breaking Up Is Hard to Do is one of the greatest records ever made, period, in terms of its construction. A later ballad he wrote that was a hit for the Carpenters, I think it's one of the great pop ballads, and that is Solitaire.
Yes.
And so he's got, and you think about, I love My Calendar Girl. Stairway to Heaven, Living Right Next Door to an Angel. These are just incredible songs. And by the way, there's another person who was neglected for whom he wrote is Connie Francis. The idea that Leslie DeGore is in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and Connie Francis, who had many more hit records, is not, there's a curious, and I agree, by the way, with the homophobia, although sooner or later you've got to deal with Elton John. I mean, if I were Elton John, I would have made I would have denied, I would have declined to be in the elected to the Hall of Fame until Neil Sedaka was elected.
Yes,
but I agree with you about that. It's a question of that sort of rock and roll guitar contempt for or fear of effeminacy, which is so ironic since so much of rock and roll, I mean, think of Duff by God, David Bowie and Mick Jagger is effeminate.
Yes, yes, out and proud. But we've got to take a sponsor break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about Burt Bacharach and how they...
Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here, taking a break from listening to a little Shout It Out Loudcast episode. Love Tom and Zeus talking all things Kiss. Of course, I was listening to them on my new Raycon wireless earbuds. They have quickly become my go-to earbuds because of the comfort. These soft tips are the best I've ever used. And at this price, plus a Pantheon discount, Raycon is really hitting on all marks. Sound quality is great too. I really love having these three EQ options because I like more bass in the music, but less in my podcast. 8 hours of playtime for the battery is great as well. Surround sound, noise isolating, and awareness mode are all included. These are great earbuds. Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order plus free shipping. That's right, you'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon. Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here. Another day, another podcast I'm working on. This time, it's Famous and Gravy with Amit and Michael. I want to let you know that I loved the Factor Meals package so much that I re-upped for myself, and then I sent a package to my in-laws. Like I was with my first shipment from Factor Meals, the in-laws were as excited to try one of the prepared restaurant-quality meals. Well, they got the shipment to Protein Plus Meal Plan and were very impressed. See, being in their 80s, anything to make the meal prep easy is a plus for them. They heated the oven per instructions and minutes later were enjoying a very delicious, nutritious, and dietitian-approved meal. One big win for me. But what really floored them was the taste. Like I told you, it's surprising how good these meals taste. Restaurant quality indeed. And like my own shipment, it really was everything Factor Meals said it would be for some seniors. No prep, no mess meals. Factor Meals are 100% ready to heat and eat. Take it from me and my in-laws. Head to factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. That's factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. Thank you, Factor Meals.
And before we switch entirely to Burt Bacharach and Hal David, I also want to mention, can you run through some of the great songs that Howie Greenfield wrote the lyrics to without Neil Sedaka?
Yes, and because Neil, after all, was a star in his own right, he was spent a lot of time performing. Howie Greenfield often had to twiddle his thumbs and write with other people. So among the greatest songs that he wrote were, just to start out with, Crying in the Rain for the Everly Brothers that he wrote with Carole King, Everybody Somebody's Fool with Jack Keller, who also is a underrated songwriter who all and wrote melodies mainly, but also did a lot of great stuff with Jerry Goffin and other people. Those are two of the greatest. You might want to add some yourself.
Yeah, I'll add Foolish Little Girl with Helen Miller. By the Shirelles, of course. So,
that's a lovely song, especially because of the drama. It's one of the few songs where they have two of the singers of the Shirelles singing back and forth. It's a lovely sort of much more call and response than the Shirelles usually are. It's got a nice sort of dramatic construction.
And it was a big influence on what Smokey Robinson would come to do later, especially with the Marvelettes. It's clear as day when you listen to that song and then hear some of the work that Smokey Robinson would go on to do at Motown. Smokey, of course, one of the great Motown songwriters. But let's talk about Burt Bacharach and Hal David. You've already told us about how Bacharach was somebody coming from the jazz pop world who realized he needed to learn about rock and roll and did. And Bacharach is somebody who has, at least for the last 20 years of his life, and he recently passed away, he more than got his due. People, I think there was a lot of contempt for his music in the 70s and 80s, but by the 90s, people came back to look at work, especially their work with Dionne Warwick. Do You Know the San Jose? Do You Know the Way to San Jose? Walk On By. So many great hits. He wrote What the World Needs Now is Love for Jackie DeShannon. They wrote Alfie for Cilla Black, The Look of Love for Dusty Springfield, 24 Hours to Tulsa for Gene Pitney, which is a great song. My Little Red Book, which Love made a hit, although Burt Bacharach never forgave him for mangling his chords because they saw the song performed in a movie and got home a few hours later and didn't remember all the chords, so they kind of butchered it. But I think they kept the spirit of the song and more. But tell us about Bacharach and David and the way they incorporated Latin music and just
well. First, I just want to mention that Love's version of My Little Red Book was not a hit. Manfred Mann's
but Love was a regional hit, and it's the one that's become the standard version.
Yeah. Anyway, they were older, especially Hal David was from a previous generation. And also, they were signed to a company that was a subsidiary of Pub Music Publishing that was a subsidiary of the Paramount Movie company. And so they immediately were already writing for motion pictures from the beginning, and they had a cinematic feel. Think about 24 Hours Tulsa by Gene Pitney sounds like a movie. I mean, and they wrote songs like The Man Who Wrote Who Shot Liberty Valance,
which ironically was completed in time to include in the movie but did become a hit.
Yes, and of course then you mentioned Alfie. And then, of course, to me, one of their greatest songs, The Look of Love, and one of the sexiest songs they ever wrote, which was in Casino Royale. So they were not writing for kids the same way that especially Jeff Berry and Ellie Greenwich were. They were writing for adults. I would suggest, however, that over the years, and this is one of the reasons why I believe his reputation waned for a good while in the 80s, is that he was not only was he aware of jazz but older music, but he was also classically trained. And as long as he was working with rhythm and blues artists, it sort of anchored his music, I would say emotional power and vitality. But over the years, his music became more and more fussy and filigreed. And also he began working almost entirely for a long time with sort of white bread artists. And the music lost, that sort of emotional grounding. It was like sometimes it was as if he were making sailing ships in bottles. And so I think that a lot of his later music simply didn't have it was formally, you know, structurally interesting, but in terms of emotions, it was sort of vapid. And I think that's one of the reasons why he suffered decline. Now I think he's sort of, and of course, I hate to say something about the recently deceased. Now he's really deified, almost gone to the opposite extreme. Certainly, and Hal David were great songwriters.
Yes, and I would also argue that the Latin influence, particularly the Brazilian influence, which is a little different from the influence that the other Latin music fans we're talking about had, I would almost put Bacharach as sort of a long distance member of the Bossa Nova movement that had such big hits in the mid 60s, and in America, like the girl from Ipanema, and there's a beat, and I'm blanket on the name of the Brazilian beat, the Baion, I think is the word in Portuguese, that was some of the secret ingredient that Bacharach and David were combining. But we got to cover, let's go ahead and hear 24 Hours to Tulsa by Gene Pitney. And then we'll come back and we'll talk about Barry Mann and Cynthia Wilde.
Dearest, darling, I had to write to say that I won't be home anymore, for something happened to me while I was driving home, and I'm not the same anymore. Oh, I was only 24 hours from Tulsa, only one day away from your arms. I saw welcoming light and stopped.
All right, we've got two more to cover, and both of them are married couples again. Again, totally novel. This has not happened before in American history, and it really hasn't happened since. This is a magical era. Who were Barry Mann and Cynthia Wilde? What's their greatest work? And they've got some doozies.
Well, Barry Mann and Cynthia Wilde's most frequently played song is You've Lost That Love and Feeling by the Wright
Brothers. Which is the
brothers.
Most frequently played song in history.
Yeah, and also other songs that are We Gotta Get Out of This Place by the Animals, which was to have been a single by Barry Mann himself. But his publisher, John Kirshner, gave it to Mickey Most, who was the producer of the Animals and many other British groups. So it stole his thunder. Another song that he wrote about Jerry Goffin, Kicks by Paul Revere. And it was an anti-drug song that was recorded by Paul Revere and the Raiders. And that was he was hoping that song would discourage Jerry Goffin from continuing to not only dabble, but immerse himself in drugs. Jerry did become a bit of a drug casualty, as once Barry Mann told me that, you know, a lot of people, you know, can do drugs and it doesn't hurt them. But some people are just, you know, fragile and they can be destroyed by them. And that is one that, unfortunately, that is the direction, the arc of Jerry Goffin's career, as brilliant a lyricist as he was. So those are some of the great songs that they wrote. Another that always fascinates me is Only in America, which was originally a satirical.
We've just done that song in the previous episode. So yeah, our readers should, if you're not there, listen to the Richard Aquila. That's a great story too. So forgive me for that. So one of the great songwriting teams, and one name we didn't mention yet, although we mentioned one of his songs, was Phil Spector. And so these two came in, and Phil Spector was as hot as anybody in this period. An incredible string of hits, and Mann and Wilde were there for him. For that You Lost the Love and Feeling, which is kind of the capstone and crescendo of Phil Spector's career. He never matched that kind of height again. But now let's talk about our final pair, which is Jeff Barry and Ellie Greenwich, who also were great songwriters for Phil Spector. They wrote To Do Ron Ron for the Crystals, Be My Baby for the Ronettes, Then He Kissed Me for the Crystals, but a lot of other stuff. Tell us about Barry and Greenwich, and in particular, their project, The Raindrops.
Well, they were another married couple, although their marriage lasted less than 3 years. And they're also famous for The Leader of the Pack by the Shangri-Las. And they, just as I said earlier, that in working for the Drifters on Atlantic Records, Lieber and Stoller encourage younger songwriters to write material. When they formed Redbird Records, they were getting on a little long in the tooth, and they realized they did not have their finger on the pulse of white teenagers. So then they hired Barry and Greenwich to write the songs like Chapel of Love, which was the first hit on Redbird Records, which Barry and Greenwich wrote for the Dixie Cups. So they performed. They had the same relationship and function and importance to Lieber and Stoller at Redbird that Man and Wile and Goffin and King and Thomas and Schumann had when they were at Atlantic Records with the Drifters. And they were earlier. You said that all these couples had a relationship to jazz and to Broadway and to the Great American Songbook. That's not really true so much of Barry and Greenwich. They were really archetypal teens in their way. And they were brilliant at evoking this world with almost baby talk. Think about do what diddy, da do run run, be my baby does the hanky panky. They had this brilliant touch of usefulness, and at one point they formed. Some of their demos were so great that they were released as songs by a made-up group, the Raindrops. And one of them is was my granddaughter's favorite song at the age of three. And that is, he's the kind of boy you can't forget. He goes, diddle-little-little-it, 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 diddle-little-little-it. Which is great, hilarious.
Let me stop you there because that's the next song we're going to play. So let's hear The Raindrops, Jeff Barry and Ellie Greenwich singing He's the Kind of Boy You Can't Forget.
I remember when I first saw him. Something told me that I couldn't ignore him.
And that was The Raindrops, a.k.a. Jeff Barry and Ellie Greenwich, singing He's the Kind of Boy You Can't Forget. I feel kind of guilty that you sang that because and then playing the record. But it is so fun to sing that. I can't resist. I always sing the Jeff Barry part.
Yeah, and also, the snippet you played probably did not include the middle eight, which is a totally different set of voices when it goes, whoa, 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 whoa. It is a brilliant, I mean, Ellie Greenwich was a brilliant background singer, backup singer, who could construct girl harmonies and sing them herself, either multi-tracked or behind the artist that she was involved in recording and producing. She was a brilliant harmonist.
Yes, she was. And sadly, after they divorced, Jeff Barry goes on to co-write Sugar Sugar and have many hits in the bubblegum vein, but Ellie Greenwich never really matched the work that she did with Barry again. Do you have any insight as to why?
It's sort of sad. You're right. Of all these groups, I mean, even Jerry Goffin with his drug problems had successful collaborations after he broke up with Carol. And actually, he continued to write sometimes for Carol when she morphed into a singer-songwriter. But the one person who didn't was Ellie Greenwich. I always got the sense, and I didn't know her well, although I interviewed her, that she was somehow fragile, that she never really quite recovered. She never remarried. I think it has to have been somewhat psychological, that she just didn't have that, ability to do it on her own, that almost everybody, there was one point, for instance, in their marriage, when Cynthia Mann, Cynthia Weil and Barry Mann broke up. And Cynthia had several hits writing with other people before they got back together again. It's sort of sad, but I think it has was partly psychological. But I think part of it might have been, and
we covered this on our Burt Burns episode. But part of it was that Barry and Greenwich had discovered Neil Diamond and had shepherded him along in much the way that Lieber and Stoller had shepherded them along, except, of course, he was a performer. But because of his relationship with Burt Burns and Burt Burns's relationship with the Genovese family, that came to a very, very ugly end. And Barry and Greenwich were definitely the casualties of that. And now let's go ahead and talk. I should have talked about these two earlier because they were previous, but we've talked about Doc Pomus before, the great beloved Doc Pomus. I don't want to cry right now, so I'm not going to start telling that story. But I do want to talk about Doc's partner, Mort Schumann, who's often overlooked because Doc Pomus was such a beloved figure and such a beatific figure. And Mort Schumann wrote the music for the great hits, Save the Last Dance for Teenager in Love, Marie's the Name of His Latest Flame, and Little Sister by Elvis, and so on and so forth. And it's just an incredible talent who went on to go to France and basically translated Jacques Brel's work and also became a hit songwriter in his own right in France and had to change his name. So tell us about Mort. I hope I haven't talked too much this story.
Well, Mort grew up speaking Yiddish until the age of 5 or 6. I mean, that was what was spoken in his home. And he had this incredible gift for an enthusiasm. He was a total mambo nut. And the most Latin song that the Drifters ever sang, which was Sweets for My Sweets, that has Ray Barretto playing conga. And you can hear, and the piano was being played by Mort Schumann, and you can hear him singing on the chorus as well. So, and he was fluent in Spanish, so spent a lot of time in Mexico and Latin America. And then he also became fluent in French. And he was off Broadway in one of the longest, he did some of the translations, and he performed in one of the longest off Broadway musicals, longest running ones. Jacques Brel is Alive and Well and Living in Paris. The man who wrote, who translated most of those songs was a man named Eric Blau, who was a Columbia professor, and he said that Mort could speak French better than he could. And one of the problems with the restlessness with Mort Schumann is that he was a young guy, and he wanted to travel all around the world, which he did, but because of his polio, Doc Pomus was pretty much stuck at home. And so the relationship became more and more strained as Mort would take off around the world. And he actually spent some time in London where, among other things, he wrote some songs for the original Small Faces and for the Hollies. And then he settled in France where he became a big star, and he never pretended that he was French. He sang songs in French about being a Brooklyn Jew. And there were some of the songs are fantastic, and he became what they call in France, a superstar, une grande vedette, in France, without for a moment disguising his origins.
Yeah.
It's a fascinating story.
Yeah, and he had to change his name from Mort, which means death in French, to Mortimer. He wrote Sha La 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 Lee for the Small Faces, co-wrote it, and he co-wrote Here I Go Again for the Hollies. If you like mid-60s British pop, and hardcore R&B. Those are two classics right there. So Mort Schumann is somebody he passed away not long after Doc did. And I hope someone can write a book about him, because his story really needs to be told in depth. Like you say, an amazing character, a world traveler who had multiple careers. But also, it is sad. And you noted that, you know, Doc Pomus was a little older, and he had brought Mort Schumann, I think, when Mort was 17 or 18, under his wing, and essentially taught him how the whole game worked, and just gave him 10% of his publishing just to sit there and watch Doc write. And eventually Mort contributed more and more, and they became 50-50 partners. So yeah, one of the great stories of a great era. And Ken, I'm going to have to drag you back to talk about Stephen Foster. So please put that in your playbook for the next few months, because that's a very important topic. Well, but thank you so much for covering this era and the passion and love you bring to this music.
Well, it's a pleasure talking to you, and I look forward to hearing what you do with what I said.
All right, it'll be out very soon. Thanks, Ken.
So keep me posted.
Follow the Let It Roll podcast on Twitter at Let It Rollcast, and check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com. Monday, Nate and Ed Legg will be back with more discussion of Michelangelo Matos' book, Can't Slow Down, How 1984 Became Pop's Blockbuster Year. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to more great podcasts at www.pantheonpodcasts.com.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.